So years before Gethsemane, the prophet Isaiah said that Jesus would take on this Gethsemane stone upon himself. And Isaiah said that he would be crushed for our transgressions, that the Lord would crush him for our iniquities. And so we look at this and we see that Jesus had to face this brutal crushing from this place called Gethsemane.
Welcome to Anchored in Jesus, the teaching ministry of Dr. William R. Glaze, founder of the Pittsburgh Institute of Biblical Studies, author and senior pastor of Bethany Baptist Church. This is Sonia Hall, thanking you for joining us today for the first half of Gethsemane, the place of crushing. So let's join Dr. Glaze for the first half of Gethsemane, the place of crushing.
A series that we're doing entitled Spiritual Lessons from Biblical Places. And we have visited places such as Masada, En-Gedi, the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea, the Mount of Gerizim, and Mount Ebal. And this morning, and the reason that we're having communion after the message today is because we are going to visit a place called Gethsemane. And this place called Gethsemane is actually the place where Jesus agonized, the garden where he went and prayed to his Father for strength to help him to deal with the adversity, the weight, and the pressures of the cross. So this morning, we want to speak on Gethsemane, the place of crushing. Gethsemane, the place of crushing. The word Gethsemane actually means olive press, and it's taken from two Hebrew words, gat, which was a place for pressing, and sheminning, which meant a oil, in reference to the message this morning, olive oil. So Gethsemane was a place, and we've heard about the Mount of Olives. And why is it called the Mount of Olives? Because there were olive trees there, and so it was called the Mount of Olives. And on the Mount of Olives, there was a garden, and this garden place was named Gethsemane. So Gethsemane was the place where they pressed the oil out of the olives. According to one historian, Ray Vanderlaan, the word Gethsemane also refers to an enormous stone that was utilized for pressing the oil out of the olives. Now, this process of collecting oil from the olives was very detailed. If you'll put up that next slide. What they would often do is that they would put the olives down in the container, and they would have what was called a millstone. And that big stone that's down inside of the container, that's called a millstone. And it was very heavy. It was extremely heavy. And that's why Jesus said that it would be better for you that a millstone were tied around your neck and you would be thrown into the sea than for you to offend a little child. So when he talked about a millstone, that's what he was talking about right there. Very, very heavy stone. And so what they would do is they would place these olives down in a container, and then a donkey or animal, and sometimes even people, would begin to push the stone, and all that it would do would be to crack the olives open. And then they would take the olives, and they would put them in burlap sacks, and they would put them in another container. And if you'll go to the next slide, and what they would do at this point, they would take a large stone. And this was called, now watch this, because this is the point of the message today. This large stone, according to Vanderlaan, was called a Gethsemane. And it actually was an enormous piece of rock that they would put on the crushed olives, and now it would begin to squeeze all of the oil out of the crushed olives into vats. And then that's where we would get the olive oils from. And this, you know, that's why I often wonder, why do they talk about first pressing and second pressing and third pressing of olive oils? Well, you know, basically, the first pressing is when they put that Gethsemane on it, and the oil that came out, you know, that was the first pressing. And then they would lift it and put it on again and let it sit a little bit longer, and that would be the second pressing. So, you know, when you look at the different pressings of the olive oils that you can purchase in the store, that is one of the reasons for them. So that they would put this Gethsemane on these olives and press the oil out of them. Now, you know, another interesting thing, and we find this in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 20, where it says that the olive trees were to be beaten. And when you talk about beating the olive trees, why did they beat the olive trees? Now keep in mind, I want you to stay with me because this is deep. What I'm getting ready to go into this morning is very deep, and if you tune out for a second, you may miss what I'm trying to say. So they would, and once again, Deuteronomy 24, verse 20, God told them to beat the olive trees. So why did they beat the olive trees? Now, they either beat them or sometimes they would start out by shaking them. And they would shake them because the ripe olives were ready to fall. And so when they shook the olive tree, the ripe ones would just fall to the ground. And sometimes they would get a stick and they would beat the olive tree. They wouldn't beat it too hard because it could do damage to the tree, but they would just gently beat the tree, and then the ripe olives would fall off to the ground, and then they would take those to be pressed to make olive oil. Now, how fitting is it for Jesus, as we talk about his passion? Anybody that has seen the film, The Passion of the Christ, realizes all that Jesus went through. So how fitting is it that Jesus begins, watch this now, he begins his passion where? On the Mount of Olives in the Garden of Gethsemane. And what is Gethsemane? Gethsemane is not only a place, but Gethsemane is a stone that was placed upon the olives to squeeze out the oil. How fitting that it was here that, if you'll turn to Luke chapter 22 and verse 44, that it was in the garden of pressing, that it was in the garden of crushing, that Luke records that Jesus, being in verse 44, being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat, as it were, great drops of blood falling down to the ground. Wow. Now, we've all been around a lot of people that have passed away. And how many people have seen, and maybe some have, but I would venture to say that the testimony of most of us is that if we've seen somebody who has passed away, we have never seen them sweat drops of blood. Now, this is a disorder that's called hematidrosis, which actually comes from people who are under heavy stress. And sometimes when people are under heavy stress, that what happens is that the sweat glands and the blood vessels begin to merge, and the sweat glands and the blood vessels may break open and spill into each other. And what happens is now a person will begin to sweat drops of blood. And so Jesus, even before he got to his passion, even before he got to the cross, that he was under so much weight, he was under so much pressure, that he began to sweat bloody drops of blood as he was in prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. And so we see here that this becomes Jesus' place of crushing, so much the more that he cried out. He said, "My soul is exceeding sorrowful. Oh, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." Now, here was the Son of God asking the Father to allow this death that he was getting ready to take upon himself. He was requesting of the Father that it might pass from him, but he said, "Nevertheless, my Father, not my will, but thy will be done," as he prays in this place called Gethsemane. Jesus agonized because he realized that pretty soon he would be facing his death on the cross. And he realized everything that would be associated with this passion that he was getting ready to go through would be laid upon him. If you'll turn to the book of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 53. In Isaiah 53, we read this passage concerning the suffering servant. Now, some people, many Jewish people will tell you that this is a reference to Israel. However, this is a prophetic passage, which is to be taken as a messianic passage in reference to Jesus Christ. And we see here that it says twice, that Isaiah says twice in the 53rd chapter that Jesus would be bruised. Look at verse 5. It says in verse 5, "But he was wounded for our transgressions, and he was bruised for our iniquity." In verse 10, look what it says there. "Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him." This word bruise comes from a Hebrew word which actually means, watch this, to crush. So years before Gethsemane, the prophet Isaiah said that Jesus would take on this Gethsemane stone upon himself. And Isaiah said that he would be crushed for our transgressions, that the Lord would crush him for our iniquities. And so we look at this and we see that Jesus had to face this brutal crushing from this place called Gethsemane. See, and I believe that one of the things that the church does so well, that the church of Christ does so well, is communion. And some people do it every Sunday. Some churches do it every time they come together. Here we do it once a month. So I believe that communion should be done on a regular basis as a reminder to us of this bruising and this crushing that Jesus Christ took. There was a man who asked his friend for a ride to church. And his friend said, "No, I can't take you to church." And he said, "Why?" He said, "Because I don't want to take you to church." He said, "Come on, man, take me to church." And the guy said, "Well, give me some reasons why I should take you to church." He said, "Remember, I gave you $2,000 as a down payment for your house 20 years ago." And the man said, "Yeah, I remember that." "Well, what else have you done?" And the man said, "Remember, 10 years ago, I gave you $10,000 so that your mother could have a heart transplant." And the man said, "And what else?" He said, "Don't you remember that 3 years ago, I gave you a kidney?" And the man said, "I still can't take you to church." And he said, "Well, why not?" He said, "Because what have you done for me lately?" And I wonder if that's our testimony, right? God, you haven't done anything for me lately. If God never did another thing for you, all you need to do is look back to Calvary. You don't need to be asking, "God, what have you done for me lately?" I mean, we can talk about what he's done for us lately. He got us up. He's provided for us. He put food in our closet. He's put clothes on our back. He put a roof over our head. So he has done a lot for us lately. But sometimes we look past all that, and we're looking for some great thing that God has done for us. What have you done for me lately? When you wonder what he's done for you lately, all you got to do is look to Calvary. That's all you got to do. And don't ask, "What has he done for me lately?" And so what communion does, it gives us the opportunity to look back and reflect upon the fact that they spit in his face and slapped him, that they beat him, that they mocked him, that they put a crown of thorns on his head, that they made him carry his cross, that they nailed him to the cross, that they jabbed him in his side with a spear, that we should look back and meditate on that frequently and oftenly and not be looking at "What have you done for me lately?" but look back to the cross and say, "I am eternally grateful for what you have done for me. Because had you not did this for me, that I would be destined and doomed to a Christless hell, where I would spend eternity paying for the consequences of my sin." So when you think about this place of crushing, what are some things that we want to learn? What are some spiritual lessons that we can learn when we take a visit to Gethsemane? And I want to share with you three lessons that we can learn from Gethsemane. The first lesson that we can learn from Gethsemane is that Christ felt the weight of God's wrath against sin. And would to God that we would not just casually sit there this morning, because even as I prepared the message, I tried to feel in my spirit what this meant to me. And I said, Lord, let me not just blow past this, but let me take a long drink and think about what this means that you have done for me. And so in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 2, 1 John chapter 2 and verse 2. It says, and we can go back to verse 1. My little children, these things write unto you that you sin not. If any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. And he is the propitiation for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for the sins of the world. The word propitiation is a big word. But what does this word propitiation mean? Actually mean? It means to appease. You know, when we think about, Brother Russell, if you can give me my handkerchief. Thank you, brother. When we think about sometimes mythology, and this provides a good example, even though it's not the perfect example, it provides a good example. You know, we've all read mythology about the gods, and then we would read about the gods if there was a plague that happened, or if there was some distress that was in the land, then what would they say? They would say that the gods are not what? Not pleased. And so we need to do something to appease the gods. We need to, and sad to say, that many illustrations are where people actually gave their children. And, you know, you go back in the Old Testament, and you can see on many occasions where people actually sacrificed their children to appease the gods, to satisfy the gods. Thank God that he doesn't ask us to sacrifice our children. Thank God that he doesn't ask us, even though he sacrificed his child, he doesn't ask you to sacrifice yours. And so these gods, they would offer these sacrifices to what? To satisfy the anger of the gods, to satisfy the wrath of the gods. And so they would offer these sacrifices, and if the gods were appeased, then the judgment would be averted. So this is the meaning of propitiation. Propitiation means that God has been satisfied, and therefore, judgment has been averted. Look at Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. I come up with all these little expressions. I believe I'm preaching better than y'all listening, but that's okay. All right. All right. Verse 18, look at this. The wrath of God, not the mercy, not the grace, not the justice, but the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. Wow. God's wrath. And what is the wrath of God? The wrath of God is his anger against sin. That God is a holy God, and God loves the sinner, but he hates sin. And so God in his wrath says that sin must be judged, that sin must be dealt with, and that everywhere I see unrighteousness, and everywhere I see wickedness, and everywhere I see ungodliness, that my wrath is going to be poured out against it. And so, in my sanctified imagination, God forms this huge ball, stone ball. And in this ball are the sins of every person that has ever lived and every sin that they have committed. And God forms them in the ball, and that's his wrath. And then what does he do? God takes this ball with his wrath in it that contains all the sins of the world, and he throws them at every human being. And every human being will feel the wrath of God. If you don't believe what I'm saying, turn with me real quick to Revelation chapter 20. every individual will feel the wrath of God. Revelation chapter 20 and verse 11. And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face fled the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which was the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things that were written in the books according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead that were in them, and they were judged, every man according to their works. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. And that is the wrath of God. That every person will be cast into the lake of fire. Every person will feel the wrath of God against unrighteousness and against sin. And that's the only way. That's the only way that God's going to be satisfied, is that everybody feels the wrath, his wrath, against sin. But wait a minute. 1 John says that Jesus is our propitiation. Woo! Jesus is our propitiation. That Jesus has taken our wrath and he has satisfied the wrath of God. So that we do not have to feel the anger of God's wrath, but we feel the love of God's mercy. And that's why it says in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9, it says that Christ, watch this now, you might want to put it up there on the screen. If you can get it up there on the screen, Hebrews 2, 9, that Christ has tasted death for every man. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. Jesus tasted death for you. He took your wrath. He took your place. And you should have been the one to experience God's wrath. But Jesus took it for you. One day, a visitor went to a church, and he got there early and parked his car and got out. Another person pulled up near to him. The driver got out and said, "Hey, I always park there. You took my place." The visitor, now, this is not Bethany that we're talking about now. We're talking about other churches, right? The visitor went inside for Sunday school, found an empty seat, and sat down. A young lady from the church approached him and said, "That's my seat. You took my place." The visitor was somewhat distressed by this rude welcome and said nothing. After Sunday school, the visitor went into the sanctuary and sat down. Another member walked up to him and said, "Hey, that's where I always sit. You took my place." The visitor was even more troubled by this treatment, but still he said nothing. Later, as the congregation was praying for Christ to dwell among them, the visitor stood up and his appearance began to change. Horrible scars became visible on his hands. And on the sandaled feet that he had, there were some more scars. Someone from the congregation noticed him and called out, "Hey man, what's happening to you?" The visitor replied, as his hat became a crown of thorns, and a tear fell from his eye. He said, "Hey,
thank you for joining us today on Anchored in Jesus. Tune in next time for the conclusion of Gethsemane, the place of crushing. If you would like to request an audio copy of today's message, Gethsemane, the place of crushing, you can contact us at anchoredinjesus.org and request Gethsemane, the place of crushing. That's anchoredinjesus.org and request Gethsemane, the place of crushing. Or call us at 877-831-5060 When you visit our website, anchoredinjesus.org, you can view many of the other teachings by Dr. Galaise. Dr. Galaise is the author of 8 books. For more information about these resources and how to order, visit anchoredinjesus.org or call 877-831-5060. We also invite you to like us on Facebook at Anchored in Jesus Ministries. If you would like to make a financial contribution, please visit our website, anchoredinjesus.org, or send it to Anchored in Jesus at P.O. Box 24034, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 15206. Once again, that website is anchoredinjesus.org, or you can send your financial contribution to Anchored in Jesus at P.O. Box 24034, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 15206. It's through your prayers and gifts that we remain on the air. Our title, Anchored in Jesus, comes from Hebrews chapter 6, verse 19, which lets us know that Jesus is our high priest and an anchor for the soul. Now, for Dr. Galaise and our volunteer staff, I'm your host, Sonia Hall, reminding you, you don't have to be tossed into storms of life. Your soul can be anchored in the Lord.